Hello and welcome to this week's episode of The Cult of SMMI. I'm your host, Scott Mort. Today we'll be continuing our conversation with Georgiana. As always, I do want you to keep this in the back of your mind. The views and experiences expressed by our podcast guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of the host or the podcast network. While we strive to provide a platform for diverse perspectives and engaging conversations, it is important to note that the experiences shared by our guests cannot be independently verified. Listeners should exercise critical thinking and consider these stories as personal anecdotes rather than established facts. There is no way to definitely refute or verify the claims made by our guests. The host and the podcast network are not responsible for any statements made by the guests during the course of the show. Listeners are encouraged to form their own judgments and seek additional information if desired. With all that lawyerese out of the way, here is Georgiana.
But, you know, it wears on a person. So they just, you know, that was their thing. And then because I was trying to figure out how to get out, because there were a couple of times I had tried to escape and they caught me, and that went very badly. I can't even remember all the places I was left alone for who knows how long. It was just, it was really incredibly abusive. And people would say, well, why do you stay? I mean, even after the fact that I had tried to escape, mm-hmm. but they're like, why did you then stay? Why didn't you, you know, take another risk to try to get out? And I'm like, you know, I had how many different sisters prior to getting here tell me I have a vocation? And there were solid sisters in communities that are authentic and real and deeply rooted in the church. And this community was brand new, and they were Franciscan, which I liked. And it was kind of my own charismatic spirituality to begin with. And I came for Jesus, I stayed for Jesus. And if these people want to be jerks, well, I guess I just have to deal with it. Because you have to deal with jerks in your life pretty much everywhere you go. You know, job situations, you're always going to have somebody who rubs you the wrong way or just irritates you with whatever. So I just thought, you know, I'll meditate on the lives of the saints. And Saint Bernadette of Subaru and Saint Therese of Lisieux were examples of two saints who the sisters in their communities were nasty. And I didn't think I was some kind of saint. Don't get me wrong. I mean, I'm plenty sinful. But I thought, you know, if they went through all that, maybe that's what I'm supposed to go through. So I thought, well, I'll just buckle down and try harder. But every time I spoke the truth, I got punished. Every time I asked a question that challenged them, I got punished. It was a never-ending cycle. So,
when you first joined the order, what was it like? Was it horrible right away, or was there kind of like a period where things were okay? Maybe things were fantastic, and then it slowly degraded, quickly degraded.
Well, take
me through that process.
Okay. Well, I first met them, like I said, when I was on retreat with that one sister from their community, and she was pretty nice. For that whole retreat, you know, we really It was a fabulous retreat because we had mass every day, confession once a week, these spiritual talks from various speakers. And when I met the Mother General and Sister Teresa, it was for the first vows of one of the sisters. And so it was a big party and everything was great and everyone was happy and, you know, all smiles and hugs and everything. And then they invited me to come back and visit them at the Stanford Convent as what they called an aspirant, somebody who's looking at the order. So I went down and I spent 4 days of my Christmas break. And it was just all sunshine and roses and, you know, happy smiles and visit the sick and do this, do that. And everybody was like, ooh, ooh and ah. Everything was just dandy. And then I went again, I think, for a couple days at Easter time, just before I entered in June. And they were kind of trying to get me ready and get me measured for my postulant outfit habit. And, you know, again, everything was thumbs up, smiles, hugs, you know, mm-hmm. cheery. And then I entered. And within my first week, you know, I saw Patricia be assaulted. The next week, well, and then at the end of that week, we all went down and met her parents. And then the following week, I think it was that next week or the week after that, this sister that I had just met walked out of the convent, just left the clothes and walked away. And then another sister left. And then as I'm seeing, I'm like, there's definitely a trend here.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, people just throughout the entire 15 years, I saw people escaping in all different ways. There was one who was, I think she was in Turkey. I don't know if it was at the same time Sister Patricia was, but Sister Jamie, you know, there was something went wrong and she just felt the need. She had to get out. So she called her aunt and I think she ended up having to go to the consulate, the American consulate there, to be able to get out. And that was a whole nightmare. And then
I've heard stories from those that I've interviewed and from those I have yet to interview, that, mm-hmm. whenever somebody went abroad, they held the passport.
Oh, yeah.
So it may have been a situation, and I'm just throwing it out there. It may have been a situation where they had to go to the consulate because she was unable to have access to her passport.
There's a very good chance that was the case.
Yeah.
I mean, there... The superiors, when I first got there, were always the superiors. And nobody else kind of moved up into that rank. I was supposed to be the superior 1 year while we were in Trumbull because I was the principal and somebody else was DRE and the other person worked with them. But the one that was working as DRE was going behind my back constantly, calling the Mother General while I was over at the school. And so basically I wasn't superior at all. Because this sister would tell me what to do, and, you know, that this and that and the other mother said this and mother said that, and everything was always, mother said, mother said, mother said. And I'm like, who is she anyway? She's not God.
Right, right.
I mean, I understand obedience. You know, I tried to be an obedient child growing up. Yes, I had my, you know, wild moments, but I understood obedience at maybe a very deep level. And this was just do what I say, not what I do. Because Sister Teresa was always doing stuff she shouldn't be doing. She was always buying snacks and eating them in her room. She was always calling people she wasn't supposed to be talking to. She was always doing something. And yet, you know, most of the time she'd skate. But it was funny because I was, you know, more mature adult than most of the other sisters entering because I was 29. Sister Teresa ended up giving me more and more responsibilities that she shouldn't have been giving me. But, you know, it is what it is. I did all the letter writing for the community. I did all the accounts for the community. Because I saw the tagline for that next episode, Where Does the Money Go? Oh, I could tell you a lot about where the money goes.
Oh. Okay. You have my undivided attention. My attention level went from about a 7.5 to an 8, right up to an 11.
Yeah.
Right.
Oh,
now.
Yeah. And Mike's like, oh, give her details, get details. I'm like, you and I could be on this interview for like 2 days. Mm-hmm. If I went blow by blow, year by year. But so anyway, I start with this doing the accounts there at the Stamford House. And anytime there was a discrepancy, which was every time I did the books, I said, sister, you know, we're still short this much. Oh, just write that off as it went to mother. Okay. But where did it go? She goes, it went to mother. I'm like, okay, no. You didn't send her $5.52, did you? Well, no, she was here. I was like, oh my God, I can't even. You know, mother hadn't been there in like 3 months, and yet it was mother spent this whatever amount it was. And it could be anywhere from like $5 to $25 or $40. And, it went to mother. I remember somebody was talking about that smuggling the money. Oh,
yes.
My gosh. Yeah. Sister Teresa would wrap money up. She'd bundle it. And then she'd wrap it around her waist so that she could take it in to Europe. Usually it was just to Rome for mother. But it was, yeah, she did that regularly. So I always thought that was odd, too. I'm like, why are you wrapping up the money and putting it around your waist? I don't understand. But okay. It was...
Because nobody searches nuns.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then, so this went on the entire time I was in the convent, because I did the books in every house I was in. And there was always missing money, always. Then, when I got to Rome, and I saw all the different houses that we had, and all the cars that we had, and all the stuff that was in the house where mother lived, it was not a wonder to me anymore where the money went. And I don't know how many cars they had. I saw at least 5 or 6 houses that they had that were ours, property of the SMMI, which technically that's not supposed to happen. And it was just unbelievable when I walked into the one house. There were books, magazines, all kinds of stuff that you're supposed to, you know, pass out, miraculous medals, pamphlets, stacked from floor to ceiling. There was like a little pathway that you would go.
So it's almost a hoarding situation.
Oh, my. You have, yeah. Actually, 2 houses like that. The general in Rome was like that, and there was another house just on the edge of Rome, and they were both packed floor to ceiling. On every floor of the house, the one just outside of Rome was like a 3-story house with an elevator, and okay. It was packed from the basement to the second or third floor, everywhere. I mean, there was just, like, on the stairway there'd be stuff. I mean, you walked up one side of the stairway because there weren't two, I mean, it was not a two-lane situation. It was always, you know, you kind of sidled up the stairs or down the stairs. And it was the same way at the general. There were a couple of rooms that were just jam-packed with stuff. And it was like, what are we using this for? Oh, mother, saving that. I can't even tell you how many times I heard the words, mother's saving that. Oh, it's going to be valuable someday when we start her cause. Oh, it's going to be valuable someday when we start Father Elia's cause. And a cause is when you you believe and your community believes that that person has extraordinary holiness and you want them to be raised to the point of sainthood. And you start this cause and get people, you know, informed about the person's life and ask for their union with that person, their friendship or family member or whatever. Talk to them about their holiness. And they did that after Father Elia died. Father Elia was Mother's spiritual director. And I think he died trying to straighten her up because he was, I think, the third one of her spiritual directors who died trying to help her get it right.
Mm-hmm. I ask, how did Father Elia die?
Oh, Father Elia had cancer and he was getting treatment. His community, the conventual Franciscans, were very good at keeping him comfortable and making sure he had treatments. And they took very good care of him right up to the end. But he had, I don't remember what type of cancer it was, but it was terminal.
I see.
There was only... you know, an outside chance at the beginning with the treatment that they might be able to reverse it. And then they eventually found out that they couldn't. So it was just palliative care after that. But he tried so hard to get her to see. I mean, because, you know, he heard all of our confessions. He knew above and beyond because... And he watched and he saw, but he wouldn't say things in public. He would try to talk to her in private when nobody else was around because he was always very discreet. And, you know, sometimes she might change something and sometimes she wouldn't. Sometimes she'd just go right in the other direction. It was disheartening.
Yeah.
But, you know, going back to the money thing, I remember... when I took my final vows, they took my entire inheritance and everything. And when I eventually came home, I had nothing. Nothing and no one because both of my parents were gone. I don't have any siblings. And I was like, okay, this will be fun. Starting over with absolutely nothing. Yeah, coming home was a whole adventure. One of my friends, who is a fallen away Catholic, took me into her house. And I won't say they didn't try to do a little bit for me. They gave me back the car I donated, which they requested that I donate. Well, I shouldn't say request. They made me donate it. And then they gave me, I don't know, was it $10,000 or $15,000. They said, well, this should get you started. And I, you know, I tried to keep things, tight because, you know, should be enough to get things going. But by the time I was trying to find a place to live and get clothes because I had nothing, and stuff for a house, it didn't go very far. I ended up getting a trailer, but that's a whole nother story. Right now, I'm actually living in the basement of one of my cousin's homes because the whole pandemic thing was hard on me and financially devastating. But at any rate, I've been in counseling since I've been home with PTSD, depression, and anxiety. So that's kind of where I'm at still.
Thank you for joining us once again on the Cult of SMMI. If you were a member of the SMMI or a family member was, if you can verify these claims, if you can refute these claims, I would love to hear from you. Please, please email me, strangepathwaysmail@gmail.com. Thank you once again for joining us here this week. Take care of yourselves and each other.